Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Consumers last year spent more than $10 billion on food delivery services as mobile apps such as Uber Eats and DoorDash made the process easier than ever. The phenomenon has changed both where prepared meals are consumed and where and how they're prepared, giving rise to so-called virtual or ghost restaurants. New York Times reporter Mike Isaac recently wrote about the trend. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Virtual restaurants, they're the ones that are attached to real ones, which means they might offer a different selection of food, that kind of a thing. Is that what we mean by that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting phenomenon where inside of a delivery app, there might be a selection to order from a real retail restaurant where you could go walk in. But the folks who operate those also might want to offer a different selection of things on their menu that's very specialized, and they could run a virtual restaurant. So if their normal restaurant's maybe a hamburger shop, but they also want to sell pizza that they still make in there, they could create something that's Mike's Pizza and put it as a choice inside the restaurant app, and folks using the delivery app wouldn't know the difference.
And a ghost restaurant doesn't have a storefront at all. It's purely delivery only.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So this other thing that's happening in Europe, and then it's starting to pop up here more in the U.S., is the idea of a ghost kitchen where inside of the delivery apps, you might get, you'll scan and maybe make a choice for a salad place or again, who knows, burger restaurant. And there's no actual retail storefront that you would go to. It's really just folks inside of a kitchen in a warehouse somewhere or, you know, who knows, assembling the food and putting it out as quickly as possible. So it really only exists for the delivery app.
You know, I went to a restaurant, tried out a new one this weekend. I didn't like it. I won't go back probably, but I was at least able to drive by it and see if it was a dump or not. And you just made that reference to who knows where it's made. Does anybody know? Is anybody regulating these operations?
Yeah, you know, it's really tricky. I mean, one of the big worries right off the bat is, are ghost kitchens going to be up to health codes? Are folks inspecting them? And some of the places that we spoke to said that, you know, they're abiding by all the existing laws and regulations. But it's harder because, you know, obviously they just don't have obvious physical presences in the real world. And a lot of this stuff really just exists inside of and for the delivery app. So it really is just a new way of thinking about how restaurants exist and how to get to them.
You open your story with the owner of a place in San Francisco, Top Round Roast Beef. Tell us how his story illustrates this changing scenario.
Yeah, it's really interesting. This guy, his name is Ricky Lopez. I met him. He had opened a restaurant called Top Round in San Francisco, I want to say a year or two ago, and immediately just had real problems with foot traffic coming in, didn't have a ton of customers right off the bat, was losing probably tens of thousands of dollars every month. And so I want to say the first 8 months, he just was not doing well. He was losing a ton of money. And then he started using a few different delivery apps, including Uber Eats. And immediately he saw an uptick of sort of orders based on just how people really eat in San Francisco. I think delivery is like very big in San Francisco. But once Uber Eats reached out to him to do one of these virtual restaurants and start opening three or four more different quote-unquote virtual restaurants for the delivery app, he started seeing his orders go through the roof, and basically most of his, he says 75% of his business is now coming through the delivery apps instead of people walking into his actual restaurant. So it's basically a retail establishment that exists just for these delivery apps.
And he doesn't have the overhead that he would if he were to serve all those meals in his restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, I asked him if he would ever consider going full ghost kitchen, which is the one where there's like zero retail establishment. And he at this point, there's enough folks that come in to walk into the restaurant that makes it still worth it for him. But, you know, if he, there's a way, there's a future in which he might just decide to open maybe new ghost kitchens that don't require that in-person experience at all, and maybe that would work. But you're exactly right. The thing that you save on really is like the cost of rent, the cost of if they don't want to have a ton of employees or wait staff, that they don't have to pay, just a bunch of things that a traditional restaurant has to deal with to stay open.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the phenomenon of food delivery services. Consumers last year spent more than $10 billion on the services as mobile apps, get more popular than ever. If I'd like to hear from listeners if you use delivery services for your eating on a regular basis. Give us a call. Tell us maybe tell us what you think is good in the Columbus area. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said delivery is very big in San Francisco. What do we know about the rest of the country, Mike Isaac?
Yeah, so right now it's actually we're kind of in the middle of a delivery, I would say, war between a lot of these delivery apps right now. Uber Eats is one of them, but there's a ton. There's DoorDash, there's Caviar, there's Seamless and Grubhub. Yelp has one attached. And so they're kind of carving up different parts of the country, and some are very big in cities versus DoorDash is got a lot of the suburbs really knocked down. So right now everyone's just sort of staking their claim out, and the companies are pouring, millions of dollars into trying to gather more customers into using their apps, because it's kind of where investors and where a lot of folks in Silicon Valley see the next sort of growth area in terms of capital investment.
We're talking $10 billion now. What are analysts saying about where it's headed?
It's really interesting. Back in 5-10 years ago was the rise of ride-hailing services, and that was when venture capitalists were spending a ton of money just sort of pouring it into Uber and Lyft and things outside of the country to get people to use them. And now that has sort of hit a tipping point where it's pretty mainstream, I would say. But now delivery is this next sort of frontier of that, and some of them are even attached to Uber Eats, is attached to Uber, and the people who drive for Uber might also deliver food for Uber Eats. So we're kind of in that same point maybe that we were 5 years ago that we are with delivery now, and I think it's only going to get bigger, and I think it only represents some 3% of the market right now for eating. So like there's tons of room to grow. The question is, do restaurants still find it valuable, or is it, a problem for eating into their margins, and how much money are they giving over to these services as well?
And I wanted to ask you, Mike Isaac, what is the business model? How does it work? Where's the money made?
Yeah, so the restaurant will make an agreement with, let's say, Uber Eats or DoorDash to do a delivery for them. And right now, it's this period where the delivery services are just trying to get as many customers using it as possible, which means that they're essentially losing money on every delivery by subsidizing those deliveries and making it cheaper for customers to order them. So maybe they'll give you free delivery, maybe they'll give you $5 off, something like that. But it's a period of expansion where they're trying to charge as little as possible. But at a point where everyone is, ostensibly making money, the restaurant, the delivery service, and, making it an actual business model, they would have to charge restaurants, some 20-30% of the ticket in order to make it worth the while of the delivery service. And the restaurant has to figure out if that's worth the volume, the new volume of orders that's coming in, or if that takes too much money out of their bottom line. So it's kind of tricky on the economics.
Has this happened anywhere where they're starting to make the pricing the triggers more realistic to the costs?
Yeah, I think in New York, New York is a pretty mature market, especially for Seamless. Seamless has been in New York forever, and I think people the cost of delivery is really reflected in what people are charged there, and folks are kind of used to it there. I think more of the rest of the country, major cities in the rest of the country, are starting to get there, but there's still, the thing is like Uber Eats and DoorDash are just intensely competitive right now, so they're going to continue to try to undercut each other and charge lower prices, which doesn't really reflect how much this will actually cost once we get to some equilibrium.
Iris in North Linden, you're on the air. Hi, Iris.
Hi. I say I use Grubhub. I'm an old crippled lady with some severe arthritis. For me to haul myself into my car, drive over to the restaurant, find the handicapped place, pull out my walker, walk in the building, yeah, it's worth it for me to spend the $5 to have a very nice person deliver a hot meal for me.
Is that the delivery fee is $5?
It has that around $5. It'll vary depending upon how far. Like if I order Indian from the Bethel Road area up to North Linden, it'll probably be more. But ordering on my end of town, it's worth it for me. Makes my life a lot easier, and I get to try stuff that I would never have otherwise.
Hmm. Does that ring true for you, Mike Isaac, in your reporting for New York Times?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think the big trade-off for a lot of customers is just what is that cost of convenience. I think, you know, around $5 to $10 is pretty much what folks are willing to pay, because look, you can like the caller said, you can just get sort of all sorts of choice that can come to your door. Usually they do a pretty good job of keeping it warmer, or you know, the actual quality of the food remains the same, or at least okay. And I think people are generally willing to pay that. I think once it gets above $5 or $10, then it's probably a little hard to convince folks to pay that much for delivery. But I think that's about right. I think that's the cost of convenience.
What are the consequences for brick and mortar restaurants at this point, particularly independents, you know, small startup type places?
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult to figure where the future of retail in terms of, you know, dine-in restaurants are going to go. I have a theory that this type of middle of the road restaurant, maybe like easy diners or middle cost tickets, anywhere from $30 to $40 tickets, might have a harder time. But people are going to start going for, you know, when they go out to a high end fancy restaurant, they want the experience of sitting down and having like a 4 or 5 course meal or whatever, and they're willing to pay the amount of money for that. And on the other end, the low-end tickets are going to be just sort of fast $5 to $10 meals, and I don't think those are ever going to go away. But I think this middle area is really vulnerable to what delivery can offer people at home, because they're going to be paying essentially the same amount, $20, $30, $40 per ticket. And if you can have that at home versus going to a restaurant, maybe getting out of the house and doing that, I think that can be a real vulnerability for those places.
I want to thank you, Mike Isaac, for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
No, of course. Thanks for having me. This is great.
Mike Isaac, he's a technology reporter for the New York Times. We've been talking about virtual restaurants, ghost restaurants, ones that supply the meals that make it from the food delivery apps. So thanks for the calls, Iris and others. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Computer hackers are turning their attention to local governments. Last May, hackers seized control of thousands of computers in Baltimore. In June, Riviera Beach, Florida officials paid almost $600,000 in digital currency to hackers. And last weekend, 23 local governments in Texas were attacked by ransomware deployed by what is believed to be one actor who held the system hostage and has sought ransom. Ohio State University is like a small city. Steve Rome is a security advisor with the Enterprise Security Group, which developed OSU's information risk management program. Steve Romick, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell us how you approach cybersecurity and when it comes to protecting 50, 60, 100,000 people who depend on their local government. Quick, and do it in 5 seconds or less.
In a simple way, too, right?
Yeah, right.
I would say, you know, the biggest thing is we have a security framework that we've constructed over the years. It's based on a framework from NIST, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They do a whole lot of different things, but one of the things that they're pretty good at is computer security advice. We chose that because we do a lot of work with the federal government, and it seems to hit a lot of the high spots for other compliance areas that we need to hit, like the healthcare compliance issues and payment card industry and things like that. It's a good fit for a lot of the things that we need to do. The framework basically lays out kind of if you want to think of it this way, kind of a building code that we comply with for constructing IT systems.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't address all of the architectural issues about how things look or how they fit together, but it does give requirements that we need to meet in order to keep things secure enough.
How much does the security depend on the behavior of the users? People like me who use OSU, you know, I'm hooked into all of that.
Oh, an awful lot. And that's sort of the the beginning and the final frontier of computer security, I think, in a lot of ways. We often focus on the technology. And the technology is important. It's critical. But it's not the kind of the end game. At the end of the day, if your technology is great and completely secure, but your users are unaware and, frankly, are gullible, they could easily fall prey to various attacks and do things that you just don't want them to do. And that can be as simple and low tech as just simply, buying payment cards or gift cards and getting the gift card redemption codes off to someone through email. You've just been ripped off, but there's no technology that you could have employed to prevent that. It was entirely a person who just wasn't, they basically got duped. Training people not to fall prey to things like that is an ongoing challenge, and it's sometimes a difficult proposition. But it's a very important thing.
Yeah, we do it. We have a training thing that we have to conduct. We have to complete. I think it's almost every year now. And then talk about how ransomware works. And so somebody's made a mistake. Somebody's, posted something or shared some information on an email. It gives a hacker access to a whole system.
Yeah, usually there's some sort of an email. It comes in, or the email may have a link that directs you to a website. Usually that takes advantage of some sort of a security vulnerability that might be on your system and unpatched. But in some cases, it's as simple as just simply, there's an email with a document. You run the document. The document contains macros. The macros execute code and download additional software. And before you know it, you've got some sort of an infection on your system. Ransomware, once it's on your system, it's going to look for important documents. It might just be looking for documents and spreadsheets. It could attack any files that are out there. It could be looking at things on the local system or looking at things on the connected file servers. And when it finds these, it will go and encrypt them and typically leave some sort of a ransom note indicating that you need to pay some sort of a ransom in order to get the decryption key and recover your files.
And obviously this doesn't happen to individuals as often as organizations now because there's a lot less at stake. an organization the likes of Ohio State or a city government in Texas can pay a ransom. How do you know when a system's been breached?
In terms of ransomware?
Yeah, I mean, are there any signs before the ransom note sent that something's gone wrong?
Oh, well, there are things that you could potentially look for when the attack itself is actually happening. And there are, you know, various products out there that purport to do that, some better than others, maybe. I guess I would argue that by the time you've gotten to the point where ransomware is actually running on the system, it's probably a little bit too late.
Okay.
You know, half the horses have left the barn already, maybe.
Well,
but, you know, it's better to catch these sorts of things earlier than later. I would say that in some cases, it kind of depends on the ransomware. In some cases, it's quite obvious that something has happened. A dialogue box pops up on the screen or, you know, something else happens that clearly indicates that there is a ransom to be paid and they want it, want you to pay it. In other cases, like I believe in the case that just happened this weekend with the systems in Texas that got taken down, I believe that was through a ransomware attack. And in that particular case, I don't think that it left a ransom note, which is a little bit perplexing to me. And my news might not be, my information might not be completely up to date on that. But usually they would leave some kind of a note that would make it obvious. I mean, after all, the whole point is to tell people that they have a ransom that they need to pay and to collect their money.
They aren't even saying which towns, as far as I understand, have been affected.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, what might that be? Why might they not be identifying the towns?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
What kind of baseline infrastructure do you think any city needs these days? Is when you talk about that, there's the physical, and then as we talked about, the training part.
Oh boy, well, that's a great question. You know, cities, as you know, I mean, they range in sizes from, you know, fairly small to very large.
Right.
I would say the larger cities, you know, probably have to have some sort of an IT infrastructure comparable to any, you know, large business. And that means that, you know, a mature IT infrastructure that, you know, can do disaster recovery and backups and, you know, all the things that would go along with running a good, clean IT operation, as well as having a good security program. I think that becomes more difficult to do well the smaller the organization is, just by virtue of the fact that, you know, you've got limited resources and you can't afford to do everything perfectly. So you have to pick and choose what sorts of things you do. And is that, you know, spending money to maintain our roads, or is it spending money to maintain our IT infrastructure?
Right. Is there ransomware insurance?
Yes, there is. I'm not too familiar with it. And I don't know what the future holds for that sort of thing. I personally have a hard time seeing what the value proposition to the insurer is, except that, you know, they want to collect money from people that want to pay them. Just like everybody else, I guess. But I would imagine that they would put requirements on the insured to secure their systems to a certain level. And, you know, frankly, if you're going to do that, you might as well go all the way and just, you know, follow a framework and secure your systems and, you know, hope to avoid the ransomware in the first place. I guess where that could come in helpful would be that if you do get hit with a ransomware attack, like there was a school that I heard about recently, I don't know the details, but they were faced with a ransom that they couldn't pay, and so they've decided not to pay it, apparently, and are, you know, basically just rebuilding their systems as they can, and they're operating with essentially pencil and paper until then.
Wow. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last weekend, 23 local governments in Texas were attacked by ransomware deployed by who is believed to be one actor who held the system hostage and has sought ransom. My guest is Steve Romig. He is a security advisor with the Enterprise Security Group at Ohio State. Which we thought is kind of like a small city, so we thought we'd find out how Ohio State is protected. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, you mentioned that Ohio State has a lot of federal connections, too. Is an organization that has kind of tentacles into federal and state government and those kinds of entities more at risk? Do we know anything about that?
Well, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of trying to say multiple things at the same time. Yes, I would say that there is more risk just because we have our fingers in so many different things. You know, we do have federal research contracts. We do contracts with big business. We have companies that we do research with that we share data, we share equipment, we share research space. Some of that information or some of that research is of interest to foreign governments like China, which makes us a bit of a target. You know, it's all over the map. I mean, anything that you do, I think, exposes you to some level of additional risk. And, of course, if you're a large organization, well, in our case, we have a teaching hospital attached to us. And, you know, hospitals have often been targets of ransomware, so I suppose we're a bigger target in that sense also. So, yeah, the more things that you've got going on, I guess the riskier things get.
Does Ohio State have requirements about what companies it'll do? I mean, does it have requirements with the companies it does business as far as cybersecurity and that kind of a thing?
Yes and no. That's an area that we're, you know, kind of trying to develop some maturity in. For one thing, it's a little bit difficult for us to even know comprehensively what businesses we are doing business with. Part of that is just the distributed nature of the university. There's a lot of different groups at OSU that are doing a lot of different things. And keeping track of all of those different things and all of those different business relationships, some of which are quite large and some of which are very small, is quite a challenge. You know, even for the ones that we know of, we can't necessarily afford to dive in deep to understand all of the security implications to the business arrangement. Now, for large contracts or, you know, large purchases, of course, we dive in a lot deeper than we might for smaller sorts of things. And we do have an assessment process that we go through for ensuring that a partner is, you know, doing the right security sorts of things and that we have the right things in place contractually to enable us to deal with potential data breaches and hopefully avoid data breaches and things like that. But it's a challenging area. And, you know, even just knowing who all we're working with is you know, I guess the first part of that challenge.
You know, every time I do something on cybersecurity, the bottom line always tends to be that this is never going away. It's always going to be this issue. It's just a matter of ramping up when you need to ramp up and knowing where the dangers are.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I've been in the security world for a couple of decades now, and I do remember early on in my career thinking that, wow, you know, I can't wait until we actually secure things and I work myself out of a job. And I don't see that happening anytime soon.
Because mm-hmm. The hackers keep getting smarter?
Well, the hackers, I don't know about them getting smarter. They have their motivation for what they want to do, but the technology is constantly changing and there's just so much more of it now. And, you know, each change in technology brings advantages, but it also brings new challenges that need to be addressed. And people don't always consider the security and privacy implications with new technology. Sometimes that kind of lags a bit, you know, as we've been seeing with the industrial control systems and the Internet of Things. You know, it's a never-ending challenge.
So you're well-employed for the foreseeable future. That's good.
Yeah, I think I'm likely to retire before getting any big fixes in security.
Well, Steve Romick, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Steve Romick is a security advisor with Enterprise Security Group, which manages the cybersecurity for Ohio State University. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Apple's new mobile credit card is rolling out to consumers, at least those who meet the criteria for it, and it doesn't always work. Joining us is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So how is the Apple card different? Is it like a virtual card? You don't actually have a card?
Well, it's actually a couple of different things. The first is it does have a physical card that you can order from Apple if you're approved for an Apple card. The Apple Card approval process is a little different from other Apple or other credit cards in that it actually happens through your phone itself. You have to pick up your phone and open the Wallet app on your iPhone, and that's the way that you apply for a card. And if you are approved, which like any credit card requires a financial check and things like that, then within a couple weeks, a physical card will be shipped to you. And this card is actually not a plastic card like most other cards. It's actually titanium. To really help drive home how special you are that you have an Apple card. The card itself is a little, physically heavier and things, but it doesn't. All of the things that you use to manage this card are done through the phone, through the Wallet app. So, like, if you want to see where your past purchases are, if you want to pay the balance on this card, all of those things happen on the phone. There is no other way to do it, which means if your phone disappears, or is stolen, there's not a website you can go to in order to pay this card off or to lock down the card to, report that the card has been stolen or anything like that. So it all happens through the phone, and Apple seems pretty okay with that. Seems okay with not having an alternate way for you to go and do anything through this card.
But are you okay with that?
I'm not. I'm a clumsy guy. I lose my phone and my couch cushions all the time. And, phones just get stolen, right? Like, that's just a thing that happens. I'm also one of those weird people that uses their phone as a wallet for their card. So the idea that I could lose all of those things and then just have no way to deactivate my card is kind of frightening. So there are a couple of reasons that I would be deeply hesitant right now to do this. But for people who, kind of live on their phone and have everything at their, at their fingertips, it's probably really nice to have all of these features, just sort of there, in the app.
There's a support page, though, right?
There is a support page. The support page gives you some additional information on how to, lock down a card if you need to. But it involves, having access to your Apple account and having access to having access to an Apple device. If you have a, an iPad or something like that, then you can get in and lock these things down. But it doesn't, there isn't a website. Like if you lose your phone, you can go to Apple's Find My Phone website and use that to log in. You can log into iCloud and you can use those things to use a web browser to find your phone and tell it to make a sound and do those kind of things. That those same tools do not exist yet for this card. If you need to lock the card or anything like that, all of those things are done through the app. There just isn't a web version, and that feels a little risky for me.
What you say Apple's okay with this. How do they explain their okayness?
That this is just like this was the feature set that got rolled out. This is how they this is early days. If they decide to add those features, then they'll be added at a later date. This isn't something that Apple is at least publicly saying that they're rushing to implement. It's just, but it's also extremely early days for the Apple card, and there's not a ton of people getting approved right now. Apple seems to be kind of slowly rolling this out to people, and it doesn't seem like there's a priority list or anything like that. It's not like a pre-order for an iPhone. This does very much function like a credit card.
It's through Goldman Sachs, right?
Right, it's through Goldman Sachs, and it's something that seems likely that Apple will be able to, add some of these additional features over time.
You wanted to talk about the Fossil Gen 5 smartwatch review. Thumbs up, thumbs down?
This is a really good watch. I'm actually kind of surprised. Google's, you know, right now, a really common refrain in the smartwatch world is that it's not really a smartwatch market. It is an Apple Watch market. There are companies that are trying to imitate the features that have made the Apple Watch popular, but very few have been able to kind of stand out, on their own and be truly successful as standalone watches. Fossil is one of the biggest watch brands in the world, and owns, you know, just many, is a part of a conglomerate for many, many other watch brands. This company has been trying to make a successful smartwatch for over 5 years now. The Gen 5 in that name refers to the fifth version of this watch that has been released in stores, and none of them have been commercially successful until this point. This watch is it's at a reasonable price. The features on it are incredibly nice. The watch itself feels like a high-end Fossil watch. It feels like a nice watch that you would wear. And the operating system finally feels like it's nice enough to use both as an athletic device and as, you know, kind of a day-to-day accessory thing on your wrist.
And it can sync with your smartphone? Does it matter which kind or not Apple?
No, it'll work with Apple as well. Wear OS is the name of the operating system, and it is designed initially for Android phones, but it does have a ton of features that work with the iPhone. Not every single feature will work with the iPhone, because Apple Music has its own set of rules, so you can't play directly from Apple Music or anything like that, but it works with, you know, Spotify and a lot of other music services that will tie directly into the watch.
Why do you think such a big upgrade with number 5?
I think Fossil is just dead set on being a competitor to Apple. You know, this is a really big deal. I think it's almost a point of pride for these watch manufacturers, for Apple, you know, not being a watch company to come in and kind of dominate the industry. I think it's an important thing for several of these companies to be able to offer something that is not just, you know, yes, we have a smartwatch, but actually we have, you know, what it considers to be the best smartwatch.
I think it's interesting when you put it that way, because I quit wearing a watch for a long time until the Apple Watch.
A lot of people did. That was actually one of the reasons that the Apple Watch became so successful. It wasn't that people who wore watches were suddenly wearing Apple Watches. It was people who did not wear watches were now considering wearing watches again. And picking one up, to deal with that, to move back into that, especially over the last 2 years, as Apple has very successfully positioned it as this kind of great fitness accessory.
It's round.
It is round. It's watch shaped, and that is not a big thing to a lot of Apple Watch owners. But there really is this kind of fascinating division for smartwatch people. There's just two kinds of people who want, you know, the group who really don't care what shape the watch is, and the kind who really just feel like a watch should be round, as Mother Nature intended it, I guess.
It makes the world go round. But it's number 5. I'd never even heard about it before, and it makes me wonder if there's other, you know, prideful watch manufacturers out there who are headed in the same direction.
We've definitely had a couple of very high-end watch manufacturers over the last couple of years try to, present this kind of high-end, virtue to the smartwatch. But they've usually focused on, you know, the body of the watch being made of premium materials, or the watch band itself being made of premium materials. Not so much that the watch interface itself was, you know, kind of a cut above the rest. And this is where Fossil is kind of setting itself apart, is that it is a nice watch made of nice materials, but it's also a really great fit and finish to the operating system itself.
It does just about everything any smartwatch does?
Yes, yeah, without a doubt. This, you know, Wear OS does not have as many apps as an Apple Watch does. The sheer volume of apps on Apple Watch is just, you know, significantly higher than many others. But there is a ton of things to do on this watch. So, like, feature for feature, you're going to be able to do most of the time, you know, the same thing on this watch that you would do on an Apple Watch or another smartwatch.
And battery life, which is always a consideration.
This is actually one of the first watches to rely on, you know, kind of a separate processor to make fitness applications consume less battery. So the idea here is that on a normal day, your battery would probably feel about the same as the previous version of the Fossil watch, which means you'll get a full day through it and you'll be able to charge it. But if you are
you know, a very physically active person and you're also using this as a fitness tracker, those fitness activities will not completely drain the watch halfway through the day, which is a problem that I had frequently run into with the predecessors of this watch.
You know, the review I read on Android Central said that being able to glance down at the wrist and see the time 24/7 without having to raise the watch to my face is a nice convenience. Parenthetically, do you hear that, Apple? And I'm thinking, I use an Apple, and all I have to do is turn my wrist to look at it. Maybe they have an old watch?
So it is that kind of turning motion that'll wake the watch up. And it really just kind of depends on where you're using it, right? Like I when I'm in the car and I'm wearing my Apple Watch, it is, you know, it is at an inconvenient angle to kind of twist the watch to wake it up to look at it. And that is really just more of a personal preference for that kind of thing. But having a watch that is always on, it sounds like such a weird thing, you know, because watches used to always be on because they did not turn off. You know, to have that feature back is something that it's a weird thing to miss.
It's a weird thing to miss, to not have it on all the time.
Right.
But, I mean, doesn't that use up more battery life?
It absolutely does. That's why this only gets, you know, a single day of battery instead of the day and a half or 2 days that you normally get out of an Apple Watch.
What about the speaker? I'll tell you what, that whole Dick Tracy thing has been a big happy thing for me.
I'm not personally big on talking to my watch. You know, I have Bluetooth headphones that I really like. You know, if I'm out somewhere and need to make a phone call, then I have that ability.
Yeah.
I will say that I have a friend of mine who does not enjoy wearing Bluetooth headphones or wears, you know, kind of normal studio headphones when playing video games.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to answer the phone while he's holding the controller is something that he is a huge fan of. And so having a speaker matters clearly to some people, but I'm not one of those people, regardless of the platform. I don't use the calling feature on the Apple Watch either.
I don't miss calls like I used to because I always have my phone, the sound and everything turned off because of what I do. I want it in the studio, but I don't want it to disturb my important conversations with people like you. So therefore, I wouldn't turn it back on and I would miss calls all the time. It drove people up a wall, people very close to me, and now I don't miss them anymore. Is there that kind of, you know, option on the Fossil Watch?
Yeah, you still get those same notifications, and you can still, you know, kind of prioritize those notifications. There's also an auto response function for something beyond phone calls. If you get a text message or something, you can actually glance down at the watch, and it'll give you some suggested responses. One of which being, if your phone is on kind of that do not disturb, you know, feature, one of the auto responses is I'm in a meeting or I'm on a call or something like that that you can quickly send to someone. And let them know that you did, in fact, get the message, but you're not available at the moment.
Right. Now, another point that's made in the review I read was that the Fossil Gem 5 is the fastest wear operating system watch I've ever used. What does that mean?
It just means that the software has been optimized to a level that we've not seen before. You know, the hardware inside of this thing, the processor running it, is not appreciably better than other watches that run this. But Fossil and Google have worked very closely together to make sure that, you know, when you swipe from one screen to another, it feels very natural. When you launch an application, it doesn't take very long to access. You know, when you try to use the voice assistant, there's not a significant delay. Those kind of things, have been problems with these watches in the past.
They're one of the complaints about Fossil Gem 5 smartwatch is the battery time, and we've talked about that. But another one is that it says it's Gen 5's rotating crown feels great to use, but the two buttons flanking it are very mushy on the review unit. What is that about? The things that you can't feel that it's clicking and making contact?
Yeah, it doesn't have that very kind of tactile, you know, snap button that you're used to on the side of on a watch. You know, especially the Apple Watch, it has that kind of longer button underneath of the crown. When you go to press that, it has a very kind of tactile response. You feel it, and in many cases, you can even hear it. This, you know, has almost like a squish pump, you know, button press where you kind of have to look down to make sure that you've pushed it in deep enough to you know, hit the feature that you want to hit, which can be, you know, less optimal when you're trying to dismiss a notification or something like that.
And outdoors in direct sunlight, they're saying the Gen 5 screen is not very legible. I noticed that with my phone. I haven't noticed it with my watch.
Yeah, this is something that I'll, you know, is tough for a lot of screen manufacturers. It's something that, you know, the sun, it turns out, is really bright. And making something that, you know, produces light that competes with that is pretty difficult. So it's something that you really like. Samsung and Apple are kind of the only companies that really can do that consistently.
There is, let's talk about Google Duo. There's a new low light mode on Google Duo. That's the Google's video chatting service. What's the low light for?
I did not expect to enjoy this feature nearly as much as I do. But the whole deal here is when you are talking to someone via video chat through Google Duo and they are walking into a movie theater or in a tunnel or something like that, and the room around them is just very dark, you can barely see their face, there's actually a new button on your screen that you can press that actually changes the brightness on the receiving end of the video. So in other words, Google uses some software to brighten the image artificially to make it look like they are in a brighter environment and make them clearer to see.
Without disturbing their situation.
It doesn't interrupt them at all. This is entirely a feature that you see and feel on your end. It improves the video feed that comes in. It's using a little bit of extra processing power, so it's a little more battery intensive to do this, but it's taking the video feed as you are receiving it and actually altering it in real time so that it is just a hair brighter so that you can see that person more clearly.
Because otherwise,
and
what's
works
the point?
Incredibly well.
And
right.
How does it compare to other video chatting services like Hangouts or FaceTime in particular?
None of the other services offer something even remotely like this. This is a unique feature to Google Duo and something that we've seen Google, you know, kind of work on in the background through other services. Through its camera software, the big thing about its camera software released last year was this thing called Night Sight, where it could take a picture and just make the entire environment using artificial intelligence significantly brighter than what reality actually dictated. This is we're seeing a similar form of the technology, though not quite as intense, being used here in video, and it's pretty incredible to see it work.
How big is video chatting now?
It's really fascinating. Google Duo is not one of those services that I can honestly say when I walk around, I see people using, any more than, you know, say FaceTime or anything like that. But it's incredibly popular. You know, Google Duo is, in the Apple store, of all places, actually one of the top five, communication apps, you know, for people who enjoy chatting. And the whole deal is that, you know, FaceTime only works for Apple people. So this is a way to communicate, you know, with a very similar set of tools for other people. And it's become increasingly popular. Unfortunately, one of the ways it has become increasingly popular is to walk down the street and just kind of hold your phone to your chin while you talk, which is a really great way of showing people what's going on up your nose.
Listen, there's nothing about video chatting that makes me look good. If they could forget the low light thing, get rid of the bags under my eyes is what I'm saying.
There you go. Yeah, we need some Instagram filters for the video chat.
Exactly. Gears Pop is a new game coming to phones. Tell us about what Gears. We've got a couple minutes. Tell us what the game is and why phones.
This is a combination of two very silly things, and it's coming together in a way that is surprisingly entertaining. If you've ever seen the Funko Pop figurines, you walk into a Hot Topic or pretty much any store where they are marketing to teenagers and above. There are these little figurines based on pop culture. You know, every TV show, movie, and cartoon has one of these figurines, and they are noted by having these big, almost soulless looking black eyes and giant heads. They're almost like bobbleheads that look like all of your favorite characters. Mm-hmm. And you can usually buy them for, you know, $5 or $10 for one of these boxes. And they've been incredibly collectible over the last couple of years. This company, Funko, has started to move its pop medium into, comic books and other things, which is kind of weird when you think about it. But the company behind the really popular and deeply violent game Gears of War has actually partnered with Funko to make a special version of its game. You know, the whole point of this game being that you run around with, giant machine guns that have chainsaws on the end of them to take out aliens, and turned all of the characters from this franchise into these adorable little pop figurines with these kind of soulless black eyes to run around in a special version of its game for phones that is not nearly violent or anything. And it comes out later this week.
We'll look for it, and I'll look forward to hearing what you think about it. Russell Halley, thanks as always for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.